war, to paraphrase the common figure of speech, is heck. And it's not a pretty thing. It's been an unfortunately common occurrence throughout the span of human history. Some people will even argue that it is an economic necessity. But today we are here to tell you that war can also be ridiculous. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hi, I'm Noel. Ben, you a gamer? You a fair weather gamer like me?
A fair weather gamer. I've had some pretty intense gaming experiences, but I don't play video games every day. I don't play games.
That's right. They kicked you out of kindergarten.
Because I don't play games. Because you don't play. Right.
But yeah, there's another good war. It never changes. That's the opening line for the Fallout games, which I'm a big fan of.
And, yeah.
You know, the point being that the war depicted in those games is a future / past post-apocalyptic nuclear war. Mm-hmm. But it never changes because it's all about the human cost and about the stuff that goes on the ground and the way humans interact with each other. Uh-huh. And in our story today, animals.
Yes, animals. Of course, we're referring to actual non-human animals, but we like to begin every show with a shout-out to our favorite party animal, super producer Casey Pegram. So today we want to open the story with, as you said, Noel, a story of an animal. This is a little bit of a legend, but travel back with us to 494 CE. There were two Arab tribes that were tangentially related, right?
Yeah, what, the Daglib and the Bakar?
Perfect.
How do you like those pronunciations?
Hole in one, man.
Not bad?
Not bad. Not bad at all. Not bad at all.
Come at us, Internet.
Please come at us politely or with a sense of humor.
That's always good.
That's great. That goes a long way with us. So this happens in Arabia in the pre-Islamic era, and supposedly the story starts when a woman named Al-Basos went to visit her niece, a woman named Jalila bint Murra. Jalila, although she was a member of the Bakar tribe, and this can be a little confusing, she was married to a guy named Kulayb, who was the leader of a different tribe, the Taglab tribe, right?
That's right. He was apparently a real pill about, ownership of mm-hmm. stuff, which would have been a pretty common trait back in those days. I mean, you gotta, what's mine is mine. Mm-hmm. It's like a very Mad Max kind of world where you gotta protect your stuff or else you're gonna get got.
Mm-hmm. Do you get gotten or do you go get? Those are the choices.
Are you a go-getter or are you a get-gotter?
Yeah, right. And this guy, Kulayb, as you said, Noel, he's a bit of a pill. He saw an unidentified camel in his territory and he shot it with an arrow. But he did not know that this camel was owned by a refugee who was under the protection of Al-Basos, the lady we mentioned earlier, right? And the man's name was Saad bin Shams, I believe.
That sounds good.
Okay, great.
Quick question right
yeah,
up front.
Yeah, yeah.
You see an unidentified camel,
mm-hmm.
A UC. Mm-hmm. Well, never mind. It feels like it needs a third
letter.
One
more letter.
Yeah, we don't know what that is. Why do you shoot it? Why don't you just wrangle it and take it? Why would you kill a perfectly good ship of the desert?
I guess because you make bad decisions.
that's a theme here for sure. So arrow is loosed mm-hmm. into said camel, and owner of said camel, Al-Basos,
mm-hmm.
wasn't having it.
Furious. She is livid. She is screaming, ranting, and raving about this. She tells her nephew, Jassus, that she has been personally humiliated. Jassus is also mad. He hears about it. He gets steamed too, and he goes to the leader of the Taglab tribe, this guy Kulayb, right? And he kills him. He kills his brother-in-law.
Yikes. Oh, man. And this essentially, no. It did.
Yeah, it
let's
did.
Not, let's not hedge bets here. Triggered, trigger warning,
mm-hmm.
war trigger, a war that lasted, as the legend goes, 40 years between these two tribes. And the idea of warring tribes in this part of the country, mm-hmm. It remains to this day, does it not?
Yeah, it does. And what we see next after this confrontation and this murder is a series of increasingly terrible events. So one of Bakar's allies thinks that this is kind of dumb. We can't be killing real people over just one UC roaming around the desert. URC, unidentified roaming camel. What do you think?
I like it.
Okay, great.
I mean, I don't like it. It sucks. But yeah, I like the cut of your jib.
Like your camels identified. That's one thing I've always respected about you.
I do. But there's more bloodshed. Yeah. Before we've triggered this 40, and this number 40 comes into play, at least in the places we've read this. So there is another leader of the Taghlab who is the brother of the leader who was killed, the chieftain, right? Is that can we use that term here? His name is Al-Mohalhal. Mm-hmm. Al-Mohalhal. I like that. And he wants to nip this in the bud. You know, let's do a truce. And there was apparently, I'm reading this really great article that sums this up beautifully on Revolvi.com. There was a tradition here that you would send one of your own, putting your bloodline at risk, you know, as an emissary to make peace. So he sent his son, Ogier, to parley with the Bakar. Mm-hmm. And they killed him. Right away.
Yeah.
This camel beef is intense.
That's good. I like that. Maybe it's because I'm hungry. But it was completely expected that when Ogier traveled to sue for peace, he would be forgiven because they were obeying the traditional rules and mores for this kind of situation. But Al-Mohalhal, as you said, completely broke, murdered Ogier, and then— This is where the number 40 comes back into play, right? Because the father who is mourning this, Al-Harith ibn Abad, recites a poem of 40 verses.
Yeah, he was the one that wasn't having it, that was like, come on, guys, we can fix this.
Yeah.
But now they've crossed the line. They've killed his son.
Yeah.
He's just free-forming this misery poem, and it all becomes kind of part of the war. He gets his men to shave their heads, to shave their horses' manes and tails off, and now that becomes a tradition, too, in Arabic culture. It's a sign of you grieving until you have gotten, and here's the kicker here, revenge. Because we all know revenge is a sticky wicket, because even when you get it, or the perception of revenge, you don't really feel better. And it's something that you just kind of can go on seeking everywhere you see it. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Well, I think it's true, you know. Revenge is as damaging to the person seeking vengeance as it is to their target often. This war, which continued, as we said, for 40 years, again, over URC, absolutely led to a massacre of the Taghlab tribe and almost ended the tribe altogether. The last few Taghlab, when they were still alive, the tribal leader we mentioned, the poet, Al-Harith ibn Abad, said his famous quote, "I will not talk to Taghlab until Earth talks to me." In other words,
never.
Never.
Yeah, because Earth don't talk.
Earth don't talk.
Nope. But yeah, the thing that's interesting about this, and as it's a good set piece kind of to kick off this episode, is the term Bassus War kind of became a stand-in for a pointless and stupid war.
A pointless beef, yes.
Yeah.
There is a happy ending to Bassus War.
Oh.
Yeah. The way the story goes, and again, this is a story, is that when the Taghlab tribe thought it was going to be the end of days for them in desperation, they dug a trench along a road where this Al-Harith guy was passing by, and a man from the tribe hid there in the trench, and while the guy was riding by, this member of the Taghlab tribe recited a poem asking for forgiveness and technically fulfilling the condition of the earth speaking to
what?
Al-Harith.
That is tricksy.
Here's the crazy thing. It worked, and the war ended. It is very strange.
Okay.
Poetry seems to play a very powerful role here.
Well, here's the thing, though, too. As is the case for a lot of these larger-than-life historical accounts, there's more than a little liberty taken, right? Yeah. You know, there's a great article from IO9 called The 10 Most Insignificant Wars in History, of which this is one in the list. And they're kind of asking how much of this is true. What they've discovered and we have confirmed and what we've read as well is that, yeah, there most likely was a war in 494 CE when stuff like this happened in this flavor. Mm-hmm. But this notion of a war lasting 40 years— is probably a little bit overstating the case. You ever heard of any other wars that lasted 40 years, Ben? Wasn't there a little thing called the 40-year war?
Yeah, named in a burst of creativity.
Burst of creativity. We got 40 verses in this sadness poem.
One verse a year.
One verse a year. And then there's another story in this I-9 article that's very similar from around the same time that talks about these two particularly warring tribes, because there were a lot of tribes. This was a tribal culture, right?
Right.
This was not just like a left and right situation. There were tons of these factions, you know. And another story talks about two tribes that went to war for 40 because they couldn't decide which had won a horse race.
And this is just the beginning. If you were a fan of our Weird People Who Built Weird Stuff episode, which we still are receiving emails about, and thank you very much, then you are going to enjoy this grab bag. Today, we are inspired to explore other wars that began for ridiculous reasons. And also, along the way, we will help determine how much truth there is or how little truth there is to these stories. What do you got, Noel?
Well, I just want to backtrack a little bit, or backpedal, rather. I said up at the beginning of the show that a lot of these had to do with animals, which is very true, but also inanimate objects and severed body parts.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
Why don't you go first? Give us severed body parts.
You want to go body parts?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay. This is one that really stood out to me. There was a war between Great Britain and Spain that began in October 1739, and it eventually merged into the War of the Austrian Succession. This war today is known as the War of Jenkins' Ear.
Who is this Jenkins?
Oh, yes. Jenkins. The Welsh master mariner Robert Jenkins, who is now slightly less famous than his own ear. So he was born around the 1730s, 40s. He was returning from a trading voyage in the West Indies in charge of a brig named Rebecca in 1731 when his ship was stopped and boarded by a privateer, a ship, the La Isabella, on suspicion of smuggling. And here's where the story gets into allegedly territory. The commander of La Isabella was a guy named Juan de Leon Fandiño, and he had Jenkins tied up to a mast. He sliced one of Jenkinson's ears off with his sword and then told him to tell the British king, the same will happen to him if he's caught doing the same.
You know, this reminds me of that scene in Reservoir Dogs where Mr. Blonde, played by Michael Madsen, is torturing the poor tied-up police officer, undercover police officer, and he slices his ear off, and he's dancing around at him with his severed ear and pours gasoline on him and all that stuff. I wonder if that was inspired by the War of Jenkins' Ear.
We can only hope. I would love it if in an interview later, Quentin Tarantino says, okay, the parrot's out of the pouch, this parrot's out of the purse or whatever. This is entirely my exploration of the War of Jenkins' Ear.
Yeah.
But it was a real thing. So he survives. Jenkins survives. And we should point out it was his left ear, according to the story. There's another version of the story that was published in the Pennsylvania Gazette in 1731, same year. It was October, a few months after the event. And it says that it was actually a Spanish lieutenant known as Dorsey who cut off Jenkins's left ear. And then another Spanish crew member took it and tore it off, but then gave it back to him and said, take that to the king.
Ew.
I know, grisly stuff.
Did we talk about the groundwork for this ear beef? Like, what were they fighting for?
There was a lot of context already here, right? Because
this has got Southern roots, doesn't it? Like in our neck of the woods.
Yeah, break it down a little bit.
Well, just that it was a conflict between land that was that the Spanish and English were at odds over in South Carolina and Florida, but this had been going on for like hundreds of years, right?
Yeah.
And then you had the formal conflict starting in 1739, and this is, you know, Georgia had been founded as a colony by this point, right?
Yeah, you can find an excellent article on GeorgiaEncyclopedia.org about this by Julie Ann Sweet. And it really, I think, drives home the significance of this for colonial Georgia. Because in a lot of these cases we're going to see with these various wars, there might be one thing that happened that is a good story, and so we name the war after that, but there's almost always a ton of other context or other factors that have commingled and driven the two nations in conflict into an open war.
Yeah, the arrow that, you know, shot the she-camel in the neck,
right? Yeah, there we go, exactly. A nice way to bring it back around, Noel. So Robert Jenkins, we should also point out what he was doing. When he was smuggling, he was also raiding Spanish ships. That's why he was being attacked and humiliated. But he did not die after they let him go, with or without giving him his ear, which remains a subject of debate today. He made it back to Britain. And in June of the same year, he told the king about what happened. He gave a deposition that was passed to the Duke of Newcastle, who at that time was the secretary for the Southern colonies, so in charge of Georgia as well. And he said that the Spanish captain, quote, took hold of his left ear with his cutlass, slit it down, and then another of the Spaniards took hold of it and tore it off, but gave him the piece of his ear again.
What do you think it would sound like to have your ear ripped off?
It's probably like a wet lower sound, actually.
Ew.
Like a... No, no, it's wetter than that.
I think it would also, it would, I think it would start low and then go high.
No, it's got a rip.
It might go the other way around because as you're losing the, I don't know.
And then you scream.
You definitely scream.
Oh, and what would it sound like to you?
Wow. That's what I mean. That's what I mean to you.
Okay.
To you in your own
internally.
Ear. In your own ear hole. Mm-hmm. That would be all that was left. We have gotten grisly with this, my friend.
I think that's very interesting from a scientific perspective.
Yeah. Let us know what you think. You ever had your ear torn off?
Yeah. Don't do it just for this.
No, please.
But let us know. So after this, there's another myth here. You'll hear claims that in 1738, just before the war formally begins, Jenkins tells his story in an embellished version before members of the House of Commons, and then partway through the story, check this out, he pulls out a jar where he's got his pickled ear.
Ew.
Yeah, I think that's so weird. There's no proof, though.
Well, do you think, because in those days, if something like that happened, do you think there was any hope that you'd ever get it reattached? Was it pretty
no.
much just like, it's done, right?
It's
yeah,
done.
It's done.
No
so
way.
The best you can do is put it in a jar to show people at parties.
if it's still like partially attached, depending on how it was cut,
yeah,
it would be possible maybe to sew it back together and hope for the best.
Right, but chances are it would just rot. It would not, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Write to us if you just ripped your ear off and then sewed it back. Tell us what it sounds like.
With medical science, you know, they can help you out. Back yeah. in these days, the jar was about the best you could hope for. You keep it on the nightstand. You use it as like a table setting piece.
It's an icebreaker.
Yeah.
You know.
Good conversation starter.
Yeah.
But what was the result? See, that's the thing, too, about these wars. Mm. Again, so much context, so much conflict. You get a name like this attached to something because it's got chutzpah, you know. It gives it a sense of grandiosity or whatever.
It's
or
got
like,
legs.
It's got, well, yeah, or ears.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. Yeah. It's got one ear.
But what was the outcome?
So eventually, whether or not he actually appeared with his severed ear in front of the House of Commons, the Parliament begins pushing the king to seek compensation, redress, apologies from Spain.
Which is going to be a theme in many of these conflicts.
Yeah.
You know? I don't think we got into it with the camel situation, but I bet you there was, maybe they didn't, they were so incensed there wasn't even discussion of pay me for the loss of my camel. It was much more based on just sheer outrage and the principles.
And they tried to send Otair too.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, it's a shame. Mm-hmm. But so they did attempt diplomacy, but by 1739, that was clearly not going to be a viable path. So King George said in July 10th, he told his Admiralty Board to start, quote, initiating reprisals against Spain.
So at this point, the governor of the British colony of Georgia, James Oglethorpe, got involved, and he amassed some forces and went into Florida, took down some Spanish forts. We've got your Fort Picolata, and you got your Fort San Francisco do Popo. Pupo? I'm going to go with Pupo. P-U-P-O.
Okay.
I'm going to go with that.
All right.
And, yeah, went into parts of Florida, St. Augustine, along the St. John's River. And, again, fantastic information coming from GeorgiaEncyclopedia.org. And his aim was to cut off supplies to the Spanish and, you know, kind of head them off at the pass and get those supplies from the forts. Then the Spanish are going to arrive, the forces that were deployed in this situation. And that's kind of what his whole strategy was there.
Right, right. And denying access to resources is a tried and true method of warfare.
But I guess for whatever reason, it didn't quite work out the way he wanted.
No.
And he ended up having to kind of take a step back and just seeing where the pieces fell when the Spanish finally did show up and invade.
Mm-hmm. And that happened in the summer of 1742. Spanish forces landed on the tip of St. Simon's Island. They got together to attack.
Just the tip.
Just the tip. They got together to attack Fort Frederica. No relation to our longtime friend Matt Frederick. Or maybe there is.
You don't know.
We have to check. Mm-hmm. But so Oglethorpe was already having a problem with organizing his army, I believe. He had a lot of diverse commanders, and the siege that he had attempted didn't work because he could not coordinate the naval and land-based assaults. But as soon as the English forces got word of the Spanish parties arriving, I think they found a scouting party, Oglethorpe aggressively led a charge against the Spanish. And what did they do?
Well, I got one for you, Ben, a question.
Yeah.
What's the difference between a battle and a skirmish?
A battle and a skirmish, you know, I don't know whether there is a technical hard and fast difference.
It's like the difference between a fight versus a scrap.
Yeah, right, right. Or an argument versus a spat.
A tiff, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
So I would imagine if we're just speculating, I think you can go with me on this. If we're just speculating, I would imagine that a skirmish is probably lower in terms of number of people injured and number of people killed. You know what I mean? It's like shots fired.
Well, my friend Webster describes a skirmish as an episode of irregular or unpremeditated fighting, especially between small or outlying parts of armies or fleets.
So ships in the night, they bump into each other.
Not the big show.
Yeah.
And
they go, holy smokes.
Kill!
It's them.
Yeah, exactly. And they freak out and then people die.
Half the people scream, kill. Half the people scream, run.
And, you know, I'm sure we know this too. You can use skirmish as a verb. There's skirmishing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And also, this is American English, which I love because it means we can use almost anything as a verb. We can say that you got Jenkinsed or you Jenkinsed that.
So, for our purposes here, we're not a military history deep dive show.
No.
The point being is that all of this. All of these skirmishes and battles and fracases and tiffs and what have you and deaths all resulted from a smuggler being kind of tortured, Mr. Blonde style.
The story of a smuggler.
That's
right?
The thing, right? Yeah. Because the story is way cooler because I'm already kind of getting a little snoozed out going through every little detail.
Well, the stories are important in that they are the easiest way to motivate
Absolutely.
A population. Ultimately, if we fast forward a bit, the end of this war occurs at the Treaty of Aix-la-Chapelle in 1748, and it returns all the colonial claims to the previous owners, and the two nations unofficially agree on the border between Georgia and Florida. And they name it, they say the St. John River, the St. John's River, rather. And because of this war, because of Oglethorpe's actions, and because, at least in some aspect, because a guy named Robert Jenkins got his ear cut off, Georgia remained an English possession. So, you know, if your friend gets their ear cut off, don't feel like you have to wage war over it.
Yeah, don't go crying over sliced ears.
Yeah.
You'd cry. I'd cry.
I don't know.
If it was my ear or the ear of a loved one.
I would go into like deep meditation techniques to try to not feel it until I got to a hospital or bandaged it up.
I think what sets these stories not apart at all, what puts them together, what joins them, is that it's these kind of simple acts that have the power to push humans in positions to create huge, horrible, long-lasting consequences and conflicts to their limits, and they get it done. But as you say, we've talked about this constantly with these powder keg moments in, like, history. You always hear about the moment, but then the details are always there. The context is always there. So,
and we find the moment retroactively, too, often. You know, we have somebody who looks back when they're writing about an event that occurred hundreds of years ago, and they go, oh, it's because of that. It's because of that fart. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But we have more examples. And Noel, you found one that really fascinated me.
All right. Well, I had two. One about an inanimate object and one about an animal. Which one would you like to hear?
Oh, man. Okay. Let's go to the inanimate object, and then because it'd be nice to circle back with the animal.
Yeah, okay. I'm down with that. The inanimate object in question, my friend, is a bucket.
A bucket?
A bucket.
Could I ask you just – this is an honest question. Is this thing going to end up being called the bucket war?
Yeah, or the war of the buckets. Or, you know, the skirmish of the pail.
I love it. Okay.
Yeah, whatever. But this one was pretty gnarly. You know, as was the – we didn't talk about deaths in the Jenkins ear war.
A lot of people died. It's
cool.
Very tragic.
Yeah.
It's not cool.
I figured as much. It's not cool. No, I didn't mean cool like the cool they died. I just meant like cool. We got that out
there.
We
admitted that war is tragic. War is terrible.
People die. It's heck, as you say. Is that an acronym? What is heck? Is this a good, clean Christian boy stand-in for the other word?
Yep.
Which we can say on this show. This is a PG-13 show.
I know, but I like saying heck.
I know. It's very endearing.
Thank you.
So the bucket war.
The bucket war. When did this happen?
Well, it was in 1325, and this also involves clashes between, let's call them clans, I guess, for lack of a better. No, it's fine. We don't need a better one. We're going to go with clans.
Family communities, right? Or they're bonded through a biological relationship, right?
This is right. This is correct. And, you know, in medieval society, family was everything, right? And you would organize around family. And it was all about your house and, you know, and I'm just using Game of Thrones rules here, but I'm pretty sure that was all based on our boy George R.R. Martin did his homework, so we didn't have to.
We just
check out his audiobooks. You need to finish those books, though, George. Come on, man. The show's going to outpace you.
It's never coming out.
It's not happening.
It's never coming out.
Yeah, so this particular clash of clans was between the Ghibellines and the Guelphs.
These sound like made-up Doctor Who aliens.
Yeah, the Guelphs, or maybe it was Guelflings, but that was in The Dark Crystal, I think, the little puppet guys.
And the bad guys were the Sleestaks?
That was close. They were the Skeksis.
Skeksis.
What is Sleestaks?
Sleestaks are from Land of the Lost. Do you remember that show?
Oh, yeah.
The
dinosaur kind of thing. Where it was like time travel. They accidentally stepped through a portal into the Land of the Lost.
Yeah, and it's always explained in the theme song.
Oh, I love it.
I love it. They're like, we were in a boat, and then you're living in Land of the Lost. Yeah, their Sleestaks were evil creatures who had evolved to anthropomorphoid forms from reptiles.
Okay. Well, there's none of that in this particular conflict. This is strictly human. No reptilians or weird little elf people fashioned by the Jim Henson Studio.
But buckets, right?
Definitely buckets. So here's the thing. I might need a little help from you with this because these are always just like a bit of a mind.
Sure.
A mind frack. You've got these warring sides that support different head honchos of God, right?
Ah, yes.
So we've got the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, who was also the king of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Pope, right?
Yeah. You specifically have Pope John 22.
All this began or kicked off in earnest, or this conflict in the region, when the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa invaded Italy. And he did this with what he believed was God's blessing, as like crowning him, for all intents and purposes, as God's conduit on earth.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't fly super well with others who believed that the Pope was the only one that was crowned with God's conduitness.
And that was that was the normal thing, right?
That was the
established norm. And you were telling me that the Guelphs and the Ghibellines were on different sides of this.
That is absolutely correct, because you see, the Ghibellines supported the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, mm-hmm. in this conflict, and the Guelphs supported the Pope. And Italy was just a loose agglomeration. You taught me that word, Ben, and I'm going to keep using it, of these little city-states, kind of, and like the story we talked about with the Albasis War, and honestly, with Jenkins' ear, you've got these folks that think they own the border. Like, if you're at a border area, you're like, no, this is mine, because there's no official lines. It's probably based on some geographical thing, but that's all up for debate, especially when you start beefing with each other. And so eventually, Frederick was ousted. They kicked him out. He was done. You know, the Pope ultimately reigned supreme in these early disagreements. But that did not mean that there were not sympathizers that remained. So he kind of had his ultimate FU moment by leaving the country kind of completely divided, right? So you still had these warring city-states, and then you had these opposing, you know, groups. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Pope who is the direct communicator with God. I think it's the Holy Roman Emperor. Mm-hmm. Now we fight.
And it's complicated because with these shifting borders for these city-states, one state could largely support the Holy Roman Emperor and one state could largely support the Pope. And the problem is that these could be very close together, especially in the example of Modena and Bologna, right?
Yes. And I think at the top of this section, I mentioned that this took place in Castello di Serravalle and in the region that is Emilia-Romagna. That's what it would be referred to as today. Mm-hmm. At the time of this this story, they were, as you say, Ben, Modena and Bologna.
And those are barely 30 miles apart, or maybe around 30, 31 miles apart. So tensions are always going to be high. They're virtually adjacent to each other. It seems like an unsustainable situation. Yeah. I'm just guessing.
And here we are back with a lot of skirmishes because they're going to be caught. They're not going to be full all-out wars. They're just going to be little conflicts between folks standing on opposite sides of the particular borders. And this bucket war,
here we go,
is just such an event, right?
So they're raiding farms and they're burning fields.
Just generally thumbing the nose at the opposition, sure. You know, and just kind of trying to mess them up because they fundamentally disagree with what everything they stand for. Mm-hmm. And yet they're somehow neighbors, right?
Okay. All right.
So, Ben, as you say, in 1325, we've got these, little mini fights, these skirmishes?
Fightlets.
Oh, yes. We're going with that. That's the new way. And they just keep happening, and things keep escalating. Then finally, in July, you've got some of these Bolognese. I can't say that without getting hungry and thinking about delicious pasta.
So we have our computers up today, and I want to confess to you and everyone listening, fellow ridiculous historians, when we started saying bolognese, I may have Googled bolognese recipe and started planning what to make for dinner.
Well, maybe, you know what? Maybe we can bump that right on up to lunch because there's a lovely pasta place downstairs.
Right.
And we've been at it a long time today. We owe it to ourselves. Let's treat ourselves. It's Friday. Anyway, though, as you say, slaughtering folks, burning fields, just making a mess, looting and polluting. All of that stuff. And they end up taking a bunch of stuff back with them over the border. They keep doing this. They're just doing a lot of damage, really, really, really wrecking the place. And then in September, you got some revenge being exacted because some of these troops were captured. And, you know, the Modenese had it. So in undercover of dark, the Modenese soldiers or a group of them, they snuck across the border into the city center and next to something called the San Felice Gate, where they found an oaken bucket.
Filled with loot.
With booty.
That belonged to Modena originally.
Plunder, that's right. And said bucket was nicked. They took it and put it under their arms and ran back and showed it off in their city center for all of the Modenese to see.
Right, and for the residents of Bologna to see as well. So the people of Bologna are furious, and they say, give us back that bucket. They better have that stuff we stole earlier in it, too. it is pretty hypocritical that they were angry that something they had stolen had just been restolen.
Yeah, it's pretty petty and childlike behavior. But again, we're seeing that with all these stories. Yeah. So that's kind of, they demanded the return of the bucket. I guess they were more concerned about the booty, but I haven't seen specifically what it was. I'm imagining it's maybe coin plundered from... I'm just picturing like role-playing games where all the money is just in like sacks that are just littered around the place.
Like emeralds or something.
You just kind of step on it and then you hear a cha-ching sound and then it shows up in your inventory.
You know what? I can tell you what it probably wasn't. It probably was not a religious artifact or a reliquary, because then the war would have been named after that instead of the bucket.
That's a good point.
Is probably just like straight up cash money or fine clothing.
Yeah, and speaking of which, that's when this particular conflict began in earnest on November 15th of 1325. A guy by the name of Malatestino del Ocho, who was the Lord of Rimini, led his people, the Bolognese, and any allies they had been able to amass to besiege the city-state of Modena and get that bucket back.
So ridiculous, man. So they were met by a pretty strong resistance, soldiers from Modena, Mantua, and Ferrara, as well as some Germans sent by our boy, the Holy Roman Emperor.
Frederick.
Yeah, Frederick himself.
That's right, but not to be bested, the Pope in question, XXIII, he sent 30,000. Mm-hmm. So they were vastly outnumbered.
Yeah, and that's an additional couple thousand knights on horseback. So what we're seeing happen here is a proxy war, essentially, over a bucket. That, again, you know, in defense of the bucket, was not empty. So the Modenese, as you said, Noel, were pretty well outnumbered.
Yeah, what, they have like 6,000 troops, I think a combination of foot soldiers and horsemen as well. And, yeah, they went at it.
And despite those numbers, they really kicked some solid tuchus here.
Absolutely, yeah. They did something that I read where they disrupted, it's called a rout, they disrupted the activities and the organization of the larger army. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
A smaller force, you can get outnumbered, but it's a little easier to control maybe and keep everybody
nimble.
In check. You're nimble. And the larger force, if you can disrupt their communications with this thing called a rout, you can cause chaos in their ranks and they're not going to know which way is up.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very important point, especially for this story. So the Modenese succeeded, but this was a bloody conflict by this point, right?
Yeah, I think we lost about 2,000. On both sides, which I would have just thought it would have just been a total bloodbath from the Pope-led 30,000, 32,000, you know, against the only 7,000. But only about 2,000 lives were lost on both sides. But that's pretty insane. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
Over a bucket.
Yeah. So what? That's my next big question that's burning in my mind. First, what happened after this? Did the war end? And even more importantly, what happened to the bucket?
Yeah, the war did eventually end. It raged on until 1529, when we've got Charles of Spain, the first, that is, who by that point became a Holy Roman Emperor. That's a thing. You can inherit that, I guess.
But I feel like Brad Pitt's character at the end of Seven. I keep going, what's in the bucket?
Yeah. Oh, we don't. I don't know. I think that's lost to time, because now the bucket does remain in its just bucket form, and you can see it in Modena, and it's at the Torre della Girolandina. And that's just like, I guess, a mock-up of it, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Just, you know, to commemorate the day. And the real one, though, you can find at the Palazzo Comunale.
Even today? The modern day?
I believe so.
That's so cool.
I think so. Book your tickets now.
Book your bucket tickets. Yeah. I've never been so into a bucket.
What if somebody had that bucket on their bucket list?
There we go.
What if a bucket list was just a list of famous buckets that you had to see before you die?
I was thinking the same thing, you mind reader. Let's make Let's make a bucket list. I want to find more famous buckets in history.
So huge props to Shehan Russell from War History Online for the bloodiest medieval war was fought because of a bucket, because I pilfered heavily from that article for this one. But it's a fun story. Fun, that's not the right word for it. But it's a ridiculous story because it just goes to show how the simplest things and the pettiest interactions can lead to serious bloodshed.
It's kind of like that old line where if you already decided that you don't like someone, whatever they do is just going to make you not like them still. It doesn't matter how innocuous it is. And that applies to states and nations that want to go to war. If they need a casus belli or they need a reason to go to war, they can just find one. Oh, man. Okay, everyone. Off air, we checked what time we were at, and we got so into this that, Noel, do you realize we've been fascinated by buckets, ears, and camels for like an hour?
Oh, my.
Buckets, ears, and camels. Oh, my.
I'm fine with that, though. You know, we gave them their due, and there's just one that I think we're going to leave on the table. So once again, we kind of over-prepared, but I guess it's better than under-delivering.
Sure.
That's what I always say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got two that we're leaving on the table, but maybe we'll just turn those into episodes of their own, because each one of these could have really been an episode on their own.
That's true.
Except the camel one.
I guess it depends on how much we want to learn about pre-Islamic tribal relations and the biology of camels. But that is...
Can you milk a camel?
Yeah, you can milk a camel.
Okay.
Is it going to be worth it? I don't know.
I don't know.
Did you know you can milk pigs, too?
I've seen, you know, you always see the little piglets suckling on the big sow.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that, yeah.
You
don't hear about pig milk, though.
No. I think we used it once in a story on a different show just because it's such a weird term. But we digress. And yes, that is part of the nature of ridiculous history. Today, we are going to wrap it up. Stay tuned for possible future explanations of the two ridiculous wars we did not get to today. In the meantime, we, of course, always want to hear from you. Let us know your favorite ridiculous cause of a conflict, a skirmish, or a war. You can do it in any number of ways. We are all over the internet. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and, of course, one of our favorite places online, Ridiculous Historians.
Yeah, it's true. We actually just recorded a future episode that features a lot of the amazing humans on that community page. So if you want to be a part of that and get in on the fun, you can go to Ridiculous Historians on Facebook and ask to be a member, unless you're like clearly an awful person. We'll let you. You know, you all are welcome.
And again, just to be completely, completely clear, do not cut off your ears.
No. Yeah, don't do a Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. Just don't do it, even to make your point. Just not worth it.
And we want to, of course, thank our super producer, Casey Pegram. We want to thank Alex Williams, who composed this track.
Mm-hmm. We'd also like to thank Christopher Hasiotis, who I had a good old time with on the Louie Louie episode, hanging out with in person, and I think listeners did as well, for being our A-number-one super bad plus research guy. We really appreciate it a lot, and he kind of helped kick us off down this road of ridiculous conflicts.
And of course, thank you, specifically you. This show does not exist without you, so feel free to like our show on your various platforms of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're feeling charitable, leave us a review. It always makes our day.
It really does. And yeah, as I just teased a minute ago, next time we will be exploring some really, really cool stuff that was pitched on our Ridiculous Historians page. And I think there's a lot to like and chew on in that one. So we hope you'll join us then, and we will see you next time.